The following is Todd Zaki Warfel and Matt Venter's talk, 10 Things We Learned from Shipping Our Own App, Stories of Success and Failure from the 2012 Information Architecture Summit. The 2012 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by User Interface Engineering and the UIE Virtual Seminar Program. Stay tuned after the podcast for a special offer from UIE.
I suspect there's going to be a lot of laughter for the next 40 minutes. So our goal basically is just kind of maybe teach you guys some things to not do, because there's a lot of lessons that we learned in building an app. So we're designers, and anybody here do research at all? Wow, like four or five people. Okay, there we go. You guys aren't awake yet? Really? I mean, look, I was out really late last night. And we got the pre-lunch crowd, so we were hoping you guys would be awake. All right, so as designers, we do research along the way, and a lot of it's qualitative, and we kind of got sick and tired of dealing in Excel spreadsheets to try and analyze, like, text data and stuff. So we built this app that kind of helps analyze it in a quantitative way. And so we're going to give you a bunch of stories that happened. A lot of them are funny, we think. When we built this app, it is out. You can use it. You can go to getreframer.com and sign up. You can do it on your mobile phone, because we actually made it work on the mobile. There's a personal plan that you can use, like, for free, and then there's, like, paid plans. But we're going to tell you a bunch of stories that happened to us along the way. Some of them near catastrophic. One pretty much catastrophic. Yeah. Epic failure. Yeah. But we did recover. I think we recovered from pretty much all of them. So if you guys have questions along the way, just, like, ask it. We'll try and answer. So in going from consulting to doing product work, one of the things that we can't really recommend enough is to have a roadmap. It doesn't have to be something really super formal. I mean, we've used Excel spreadsheets. We used Dundun. There's a bunch of tools out there. But the main thing is to have a product roadmap and to write it down. Be flexible about it. What we found was when we had a roadmap and we would kind of pick two or three features to focus on and say, all right, for the next week, this is our sprint. We're going to do these three features and only do these three features and not let anything else creep in. We actually ship that stuff like on a weekly or maybe every 2 week basis. And then the times we're like, I don't know, Matt, like, you know, we'll do some new auto lookup list. And it wasn't really defined. That thing stretched out for 3-4 weeks.
Painfully long. If you don't define it, if you don't define your sprint, how many of you know what Agile is? Are using Agile framework, right?
Do you know hate Agile?
How many hate Agile?
Previously hear the term?
Yeah. A couple, that's cool. You guys know about defining done, right? Defining done is the point at which the feature you're working on is ready to ship. You define done for your whole project. So when is the app good enough to ship? If you don't define done, you can't build a roadmap. And if you don't write the roadmap down, you're going to lose your way. And we did that so many times.
That happened to us a bunch of times. Like,
it happened to us so many times. We cannot reiterate enough. You need to write it down.
We good?
You have to refer to
it.
We do daily stand-ups.
No, you can't hear me? I got a green light. It says I'm on. I'm on. Mike's not on.
I think you're on.
I don't know.
We do daily stand-up meetings, Agile style.
I'll just talk really loud.
You good?
Yeah.
So we do daily stand-up meetings, Agile style. And if we're not looking at the roadmap, we are in the weeds. We're talking about features that are 3-4 sprints down the line. We're not looking at the feedback we're getting. We're not referring to our
points.
Wow.
This is failure, right? Awesome. Yeah, but I think literally, I mean, every time that we didn't kind of try and stick to the plan, it just, yeah, it was almost like there was no end in sight, and it was kind of frustrating. I got really frustrated because, like, you know, I would be working on stuff that Matt was dependent on. He really couldn't predict when that was coming down the pipe. The guy who's our back-end developer couldn't predict when it was coming down the pipe. We couldn't really predict when he was going to ship the thing, and it just got really, really aggravating. So have some type of a roadmap and write it down. Don't just keep it in your head. Put it on a whiteboard. Do something.
Make sure everybody's looking at it. If you're working in a distributed team like we were, put it online. Make sure everybody can look at it and edit it. If it's on your wall and your dev lives, 3,000 miles away, he can't see it. So he doesn't have a context for that discussion. Make it visible.
Yeah, this is a big one.
So when you're building an app for yourself, there's kind of the propensity to try and feel like Superman. Like, I'm going to build everything from the ground up.
Anybody in here, like, actually, like, write code, like, back-end code, like, build a couple people?
It's good.
Like, you know, you guys, it's, like, really easy to kind of guess, I'll just go build my own, right? Because most likely whatever is out there is probably not exactly what I want. So I'm going to build exactly what I want, and I'm going to do it in a day, which, come on, never happens in a day. It takes, like, 3 weeks.
Yeah, you need to use frameworks that are out there. There are so many brilliant people.
Anybody using HTML5 boilerplate or something like that? Anybody using like a CSS framework like 960 Grid, or maybe you wrote your own? Yeah, jQuery, amazing jQuery. Anybody using like a server framework like Rails, .NET,
Yeah. Right?
These are all things built by smart people that make our lives easier. Don't roll your own unless you absolutely have to. Definitely use these as a starting point. We use a thing called AutoLookup, it's a jQuery plugin. We needed a way to quickly look through a big data set and drop tags onto a piece of data here.
Yeah, so I can honestly suggest, I think Drew Wilson actually wrote this one. I mean, not the one we're using now, but like this is the one we started with.
We started with this plugin. In our prototype, we put it in. It worked brilliantly. Okay, find the string, drop it in, the tag, looks great. But we didn't really understand how that was going to scale with our large data set. So once we got it into production, our dev was like, this is not going to work. It's really slow. It's kind of wonky. So at this point, we're like, well, it kind of outlived its utility. So we have to extend it to work with our actual product. But we used some starting point that somebody else
yeah,
developed,
and
that's important.
And the version we're using now is, I think it's still based on Drew's plugin, and we've just kind of extended it out. There are other times where we kind of went way beyond what we could extend. So there's another thing called IsTaggable, which is a jQuery plugin. And so we've got this piece of functionality in the app where you can tag your data sets. And then we show you like all the descriptive tags on the right-hand side. We've got these counts to the right that tell you how many pieces of data are tagged with that tag. So like in this one, there's 294 pieces of data tagged with WM customer, 275 with non-customer, 83 tagged with quote. And then what happens when you click one of these tags, like in this case, I think it's like pain point, on the fly, in real time with Ajax, we re-index the entire data set. And to the left, we have these split counts that show you basically matches, so kind of cross-references. So right now what's happening is I've selected, I think, pain point, and what it's showing me is there's 294 items tagged with WM customer, but 65 of those share a relationship between pain point and customer, 58 share a relationship between pain point and non-customer. So we're able to actually see like how many connection points there are, which tells us like is that a strong connection or a weak connection. And the plugin really didn't do this at all. It did the stuff on the right, which is great. Just tells us how many total. And then I was like, oh, we need to do this really cool thing where we do split counts and we show a relationship match on the left-hand side. And Bill, our developer, is like, yeah. And I was like, what, dude? It's just code. He goes, yeah. Do you know what you're asking me to do? And I was like, yeah, I want you to do split counts. And I prototyped it out. It's pretty straightforward. He's like, no. He's like, you understand, like, you're asking me to re-index on the fly these relationships and do it to infinity. Because right now, if I go and click that 58, it's going to basically pull a match. It's going to do a SQL query and do an and join, pull that 58 down, then re-index through 357 tags, right? And make those cross-reference relationships on the fly in real time and show them to me again. And then if I click on the right-hand side one, like quote, and hit 83, it technically does a SQL OR query and then re-indexes again on the fly in real time, rebuilding those relationships. And the crazy thing is, with this little thing, you can do like a SQL and, or, without even knowing, I don't even know what that meant, but you can do it visually, just clicking stuff, and it writes code like on the fly and reindexes in real time. So the plugin didn't do that. It did this part. And then Bill tried to extend it, as Matt talked about, for this other plugin. And he was like, that ain't going to work. And so we started writing straight SQL, which is really inefficient. And then basically the Rails community told him this was impossible. Jared Spool told me this is called an inner-outer join. I don't know what that means, but I was like, what's that mean? He was like, it's impossible. People don't do it.
We did it.
We did. Yeah. So it took us
yeah!
two. Yeah, exactly. Dude, seriously,
Thank
Bill
you.
Called me. He was like, dude, I got it. And I was like, sweet. He goes, no, I mean, I got it. And I was like, yeah, sweet. He goes, no, you don't understand. Like, people can't do this. And he was really excited about it. It took him about 2 weeks after we broke active record in Rails pulling this off.
We broke a lot of things. You're going to find that it's a pattern.
Yeah, yeah. So he broke active record in Rails, finally figured out how to do it. He is going to give it back to the Rails community because apparently people have been trying for 3 years in the Rails community to do this and no one's pulled it off. But this was a point where we had basically blown past the capabilities of a plugin, tried to extend it, and he was like, this is just too nasty, and just started from scratch. The great thing was because he had a plugin to look at, it did give him some type of like data modeling structure to kind of see what was working and kind of go from. And then he also knew where it was broken, so he knew kind of like what to work around. So in some cases, they're useful actually to use. In other cases, they're useful just for a reference point. Yeah? So anybody use Git in here? Yeah, dude, Git will save your ass.
And how?
I cannot tell you the number of times where... So Git's like version control. So... Think of, like, anybody use, I don't know, does Bridge do this? Does Bridge do, like, version control stuff? No? All right, so basically what version control is, as you're working on stuff and you save it, it kind of makes a deposit in a bank account, right? And you keep making deposits in a bank account, and then at some point you transfer the money to some other account. So Git is kind of like if you're working on a big Photoshop file, you know, you can make these like small, like Command S saves for a while, you know, work on it for a course of 2 or 3 days, and if something goes bad, you can kind of go back in the history and roll something back, right? But if you imagine working on a Photoshop file and there is no history, and you work on it for like 3 days, and then the file crashes and it's all gone, does that ever happen to anybody? Try to skip. Does that ever happen to anybody? Yeah, that's like painful, right? So this totally saves your ass. Basically, Git is a way with code to basically just kind of save things and commit them into a bank account and then eventually pull them back out. We had a case where when I was redesigning the mobile admin interface, the admin interface to work on a mobile phone, we've got this piece of functionality where your data is portable, so it's not stuck in the app. So you're working on a project and then you want to get your data out for some reason. And this happened. Some people wanted to export it out and look at it in Excel, which we're like, we built the app so you don't have to use Excel, but okay, that's fine. So we can export your data and then get it to you. And we've had this functionality in for a while. And I was reworking the interface to work on a mobile phone, and I accidentally removed that functionality. And it just so happened, like, and I didn't realize I'd removed it. So I'm like looking at my mobile phone, I'm like, ah, dude, this looks sexy. It's great. It works on a mobile phone. This is awesome. And then like 2 days later, some client, a paying customer was like, oh yeah, we need to like export that project and do some stuff with it. I was like, yeah, no problem. And I signed in the admin console and that function is not there anymore. Whoops. So I got Bill and IM and I was like, dude, need to export the data. And he was like, just go in the admin interface. I was like, well, I would do that, but it's not there. And he was like, what do you mean it's not there?
We broke
it's been there for 2 months. And I said, yeah, I accidentally removed it. And he said, then go into Git and put it back in. And I did. I went in to Git, went back like a couple days, found this little bitty Rails tag, shoved it back in the admin interface, problem solved. This happened to us like...
countless times.
Yeah, I think like on a weekly basis we were doing this.
A weekly basis. The point to take home here is really that you don't need to use Git. You can use any kind of version control. There's an alternative called Subversion. The point is you need to use it.
And they're hosted,
they're
right?
They're hosted. It's we really use cool. GitHub. It's like $12 a month. It's the best $12
you ever spend. $12 a month to save your ass.
$12 a month
a lot of times.
And get to know your version control system. They make a lot of good GUI tools like Tower. GitX is a free solution. You guys can use these, right, and they're very point and click, and it's a good way to get into it. But really, read some material on the fundamentals of version control, because it's its own kind of language.
Yeah, it's, the other thing that's great, too, is like if you know Matt and I were working on design, and Bill was working on the back end, and sometimes like you know we'd be working on the same, well, actually a lot of times, we work on the same CSS file, and Git does a pretty good job at merging that stuff together, so you can work on the same files, and you'll just kind of usually figure out most of the changes and just kind of like mash them together. It's not flawless. There are times we had to manually kind of fix some things, yeah. But it's a huge time saver. Yeah. Huge time saver.
$12 a month, say it with me now. Git will save your ass. Come on.
All right.
Git will save your ass. There you go.
So, when you've got several people working on an app, especially several designers, several people writing CSS, several people writing HTML, several people working on the back end, this is probably one of the things that ticks me off the most about building this app. We had someone early on working on the project who was constantly rewriting the DOM structure, so constantly rewriting the HTML in the files that basically were the interface. You know, just to kind of like, oh, I want to change something here, I want to change something there. You know, maybe I don't want to do an unordered list anymore. Maybe I want to do like a list of divs, maybe I want to change it to an ordered list. Maybe so just constantly changing like the HTML structure on an ongoing basis. And early on, what happened was that we were building stuff in HTML, then HTML5, and we would basically use PHP to kind of use for include files. So we were prototyping in HTML, basically. And then our back-end developer, Bill, would take that stuff and then pull it into, he'd like Railify it, right? So he'd like pull it into Rails files and make it actually work. And this became a huge issue, because what happened was this one person was constantly changing the HTML files, and then Bill, our back-end developer, would have to take like 3 or 4 days and then take all that new DOM structure and then go back in and make like new Rails files in the app for it and then shoot them back out. And there was a period of, I don't know, like probably 5 or 6 weeks where I think he like redid all the Rails files that the app actually uses to generate the interface like 4 times, but we didn't actually make any forward progress on the application. And he was actually starting to get really pissed off about it. He was like, you know, you know, you guys are changing stuff in the DOM structure. We're not gaining any benefit other than somebody is like tweaking with the HTML structure for the interface. But there's no net benefit here at all. And he's like, I'd really like for us to think about, you know, this process that we're using, because I feel like I'm burning a lot of cycles and really like not moving the application forward at all. And so let's get back to the roadmap. Let's kind of plan this stuff out. And like, I want to actually like move the application forward. So you really got to consider, as you're changing stuff in the application, like what the impact is downstream, right? Like if I would change stuff, again, it would have impact on Matt. And then Matt would change stuff, that impact would have impact on Bill. And, you know, so part of this is just, you know, keeping each other in the loop, letting each other know what's going on, and just kind of be a little more considerate of each other, right? We wasted a lot of time and effort with this. And again, it was, you know, a lot of work getting put in, but not really being productive and not actually moving the app forward.
Got to keep the communication lines open. In our situation, we had, again, a distributed team. So we're working with a developer who's not local. And if we start doing stuff in our own little bubble in Philadelphia, and he's in upstate New York and has no idea what's going on, and all of a sudden we start slamming in all these commits, and he's like, what the hell is happening here? You know, look at the roadmap, guys.
Yeah, so, but yeah, he was like, why did this thing break again?
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of why did it break again.
Hey, so remember that thing we were talking about, that catastrophic failure? This is kind of the crux of it. Our database, all of the data for all of our users, and we had hundreds and hundreds of people in there with data. Completely out of sync. Now we work on a model where we have a development server.
We basically created two servers now, so we had like a proper dev and
we have a proper staging server, which is a good practice.
We didn't originally, we had like all in one server.
Broke that. We have a staging server and a live server, production server. That's the one that we kind of want everybody to be using. Well, what happened was when we migrated to this model, we sort of caused a rift in the data where all of our new registrations and all of the new accounts and all of the new projects were getting put onto the live server.
Yeah, the production server.
The production server. So all the legacy stuff, everybody who already had an account, already had some projects, that was all on the staging server. But the trick
was also on the, it was on the production server too.
Staging server.
No, it was on production too.
That's not what Bill said.
No, Bill took a snapshot and then moved it to production. So for some time it was in sync.
There are so many mad people, I can't even believe what.
So here's the thing, we actually don't know what happened.
Yeah.
We still to this day, we've gone through this story probably 50 times. We still don't know exactly what transpired. What we do know is that we had, at some point, Bill took a snapshot of the one server, made a new one, and all the signups were supposed to go to the new server, and I think they did, but we're not actually sure.
Yeah.
What happened was, the app kept running, and over the course of 2 weeks, somehow, people were adding information into the application, and it was getting stored somewhere. Yeah, this is what was really awesome, was like people would like, I added like all these observation notes, I know I did, and then I go to my explore screen to like look at them, and like half of them are missing, and we're like, oh no, and so then we pinged Bill, and Bill's like, well, good news and bad news, I'm like, all right, that's the good news, he goes, we have all the data, I'm like, yay, I'm like, what's the bad news, well, some of it's in the production database, and some's in the staging database. I'm like, dude, I thought you did a snapshot and moved it. He goes, well, I did, but it turns out that when we did this migration, some of the URLs in the application for certain features were hard-coded.
Never do that.
Oh, yeah. And so we kind of missed like five of them, and I was like, uh-huh. He's like, yeah, well, it turns out those five actually send people to the old staging server. So, and what's really cool is actually within the same project sometimes you can be submitting stuff to production, but in other cases you're submitting to development. And so we have all the data, and I was like, how do we fix it? This is where it gets great. He goes, manually? I'm like, what do you mean manually? He's like, I actually have to go through every single individual note one by one and move it to production and then rebuild the relationship. It took him like 4 days to do this.
I'm surprised
manually.
He still wanted to work with us.
Yeah. What's really killer is that this actually was discovered the day before we were announcing the public beta at a conference. And that next day we got like 500 signups. And I don't know if Nate Bolt's in the room, but Nate was next to me when I found this out, and he was like, dude, what's wrong? I'm like, oh my God, there's like this catastrophic issue right now with our database. I started telling him about it, and he started laughing. He goes, oh, that's happened to us like a dozen times. Yeah, this was probably like one of the most painful points in the entire like application process. We were totally freaking out about this.
this one's important for us. Now, how many people code in the room? Some code? Any code? Good. Okay, so you're all familiar with maybe one, two languages, HTML5, CSS, maybe you do some JavaScript. We started building the app in a PHP framework. So all of our prototypes we did on a PHP engine. And that would work. That's great. Like, we're very fast at that. But the bottleneck happened when we would turn over our work to the developer. And he would have to take all these PHP files and then turn them into Rails. So now, again, we're talking about he's spinning wheels on just working on our code getting into Rails. He's not actually pushing the back end forward at all. So
yeah, he would basically just take like the HTML structure we've got in the PHP files, yep, and then basically go build like these Ruby versions of mm-hmm. the HTML files, which look a lot like HTML. It's just they have a different extension, and there's like some little like weird tag things in them. But it actually looks fairly similar to the stuff we were already writing.
Yeah, we just had to get over that fear. We're like, oh my God, Ruby's for developers. We're not good enough to do that. And step out of our comfort zone and really say, all right, we can do this, right? And why can we do this? Well, because if we learn this, it's going to push the product forward. So what we did, we started really simply. We opened up some RHTML files. And like Todd said.
Yeah, they look like HTML
files. They have a couple squiggly lines
of
percent signs. And okay, well, it's a little foreign, but when you really get
into it,
but like
95% of it looks like an HTML file.
Right. So we decided, instead of making our poor developer who's already mad because we, you know, the database thing, we broke that, who's already mad about that, do all this extra work that we're pushing over in PHP, we said, you know, we're just going to do this. So we started small, made small DOM structure changes.
And we weren't very fast at it at first.
We're not fast. But even though we're a little bit slower ourselves, holistically speaking, the product is better for it because there's no bottleneck anymore between us turning over files to the developer.
Yeah, and like then Bill could focus on the back end stuff,
yeah,
and we could, you know, even though we were a little slower at first, kind of getting up to speed on like working in these what they're called views, but they're basically like, you know, Ruby HTML files. You know, we got up to speed fairly quickly and got comfortable with it, and then he was able to focus on the back end stuff, and we weren't basically wasting his time, you know, taking HTML files that were kind of had PHP includes, and then like, you know, redoing all of them in a, you know, an HTML file that basically has some Ruby code in it. And so we were able to like basically pick up the slack and just kind of move the ball forward faster.
Yeah, so we had to get out of our comfort zone. So take that leap and your app will be better.
Yeah, the other thing that actually came out that was really cool was once we got more comfortable with it, we could kind of, you know, figure out what this little Rails tag did. And so we were actually able to build like new screens without him getting involved at all. And just like, oh yeah, we just copied this tag from over here. We built like a new HTML file, shoved that tag in there, like it worked. And we got all excited and he was like, well, guys, it's about time you start doing that. So in the end, actually, it was a huge benefit. We built this app originally for ourselves, used it on client projects, and then, you know, as we would talk to other practitioners, they're like, I would love to use that. Okay, fine. So we did like a private beta with a couple dozen customers. Then we did, you know, like a public beta, and that went on for, you know, months. I think the private beta went for like 9 months, and then a public beta for like another maybe like, I don't know, couple months. And then, you know, basically we opened it up. But all along the way, we actually treated it kind of like a client project. So we would actually contact customers that were using it and do like a Skype screen sharing session and watch them use the application. Because we built it the way that our process had worked, and we knew how we intended it to be used, but we were constantly getting feedback from customers that maybe one little thing didn't make sense to them, or they were, you know, I'm trying to do this piece of functionality, and I don't know if it's not supported or not. And, you know, we could pass emails back and forth for like a week, or just hop on a screen sharing session with them for 20 minutes and actually just watch them use our application. That's a novel idea, right? So we did. We would just do these screen sharing sessions and just have them like fire up the application and use it. And we discovered like really amazing stuff, just like you would for a client. So we were kind of trying to eat our own dog food and treat it like a client project. And so we tried to involve them like on a fairly regular basis.
When you get customers involved early, especially in private betas, that's a sense of ownership, right? I'm part of the cool crowd. I'm in. These people care about me. You know, we really wanted to bolster that emotion throughout the community. And they start talking too, like, I'm in the private beta. Did you hear about this new app?
Yeah, it gets you like tons of street credit. Like, and then you can get away with all kinds of stuff. Like if something breaks, they're like, ah, don't worry about it. No big deal. Because you let me in on the private beta.
If you reach out, especially in a small private beta, personally to people while their data is kind of falling through these potholes that we've dug, they're more receptive to that, you know, lag and uptime. So, you know, they'll understand when things go wrong if you're reaching out to them. And that's great because it builds a sense of community.
Yeah, so I'm not really going to dig too much into whether or not you should go for funding. We did explore actually going for investor funding at some point and eventually decided against it for a couple reasons. But the one thing I'll say is that if you do decide to go after funding, it's a huge time suck. basically, it's not something you can do part-time. It's something that some person on the team pretty much has to just face the fact that you're not going to do anything but this for, like, the next 6 weeks. It completely consumes every ounce of your time. You know, every minute that you spend basically going after funding will take 10 minutes away from working on the application. So just if you do go down that route, just, you know, have somebody on the team, like, that's their dedicated, you know, focus for the next 6 weeks to 2 months or so, and just don't really expect that they're going to be working on the application, right? So in some cases, it's definitely worth going for. Other cases, you know, it may not. But the only thing that I would say is that, you know, you got to be really cautious about this because it can actually take up a huge amount of your time without you, you know, realizing it. I mean, we had gone to some investor thing in Philadelphia, and one of the guys got up from some media company that Google bought for like $50 million or whatever, and he had said, like, in hindsight, they didn't realize how much time it was going to take, and they had spent like 3 months basically chasing after investors, and like realized all of a sudden they had basically just, you know, kind of like let the application sit because they were so focused on basically going after investors. And this guy basically said, like, you know, had we known better, we would have had, like, one person doing it instead of, like, three of us doing it part-time because you can't really do this part-time. So if you're going after it, just, again, the main point is, you know, have somebody dedicated and don't really expect them to be doing anything else for quite a while. This became our number one feature, like, shipping the thing, right? And we have a pretty high bar, I think, for level of quality. So this doesn't mean, like, ship crap, right? This means that the most important thing you can do is build something that functions, that customers will use, that you can take a sense of pride and ownership in, and get it out as quickly and as often as possible. Because if you don't, you can't really get feedback on it, you can't really tell whether it's working or not. And the reality is that software's never really done. Like Matt had talked about this notion earlier in Agile about, like, you know, defining what done is. Done's kind of like a relative concept. Done basically is like it's done enough to get it out there for people to use. You know, you can really get caught in the weeds of, you know, trying to make it perfect, and then you never ship the thing, and now you've got, what was that video game like for 10 years? Duke Nukem?
Duke
right?
Nukem
yeah, you're like Duke Nukem forever.
Finally
right?
Shipped 15 years later.
Yeah, you know, lots of money, and like, you know, then you drain all of it, and 10 years later you have
total
no app.
Total critical flop, by yeah. the way. So think about that product roadmap. You wrote it down. You built it. Well, there's another secret about the roadmap. There really is no end point. You just keep tacking on new destinations and new goals. It's a never-ending journey. Once you ship it, once it's live and you have people paying for it and using it, milestone behind you. But we have an infinite number in front of us. As long as the software is alive, we're still putting points on that map.
Yeah, to that point, actually, like paying customers. So I think we probably worked on our app for like a year and a half before we actually like opened it up to like paying customers.
Yeah.
In hindsight, I wish we'd done it sooner because the first week that we opened it up, we got paying customers. In the first week. And I was like, cause, you know, we were like, I don't know if people pay for this or not. And then, like, you know, people said they would. And finally, like, all right, we're going to flip the switch, see if people pay. And we had, like, a couple dozen paying customers the first week. And then I was like, man, we could have had paying customers, like, 6 months ago if we had basically shipped that part sooner, right? So that's a big lesson for us. This last one's probably my favorite. It's probably also the one that's, I don't know, probably the harshest.
Yeah, it probably hurts us the most.
Yeah. I originally had titled this slide, "You've got the stupidest customers in the world." Because that's what I felt like when this thing happened to us. But then we realized that it's not so much that you've got the dumbest customers, it's that your customers will do the dumbest stuff in the entire world. So we had this guy that created a project and somehow managed to get all of his information in the wrong place in the app. And he sent me a screenshot. I was baffled. I was like, how in the world could you possibly do this? He must be like the world's biggest idiot. And I got on the phone with him. I did a screen sharing session. And I was like, well, I need you to walk me through like exactly what you did. Because if this is a flaw in the app, we need to fix it. And he was like, well, and I went to the screen and he just randomly starts typing stuff in. Like, and I was just probably like typing stuff. I'm like, no, hold on. Like, I actually need you to walk me through exactly what you did. Because you just randomly typing stuff in doesn't actually help us see if this is a bug or like if the app is just like really not that usable. And so then he started to actually kind of like repeat the process. And I remember I got off the screen sharing session and then I turned to Matt and I was like, so let me tell you what this guy did. And when I got done, Matt's reaction was like,
that's impossible.
Actually,
no one is
was,
that dumb.
Yeah, he was much angrier than that. He was kind of like, this guy is an idiot. And I was like, I know, we've got the dumbest customers in the world. And then we let it kind of set in for a little bit. And we're like, wait a minute, if our customer just did the dumbest thing in the world, that means that he did it in our app, and that means that we actually built an app that was enabler to basically give him the vehicle to do the dumbest thing in the entire world. So what's that mean to us? Right? Like, you know,
we're dumber, actually.
Yeah, like, we clearly did something so stupid that enabled him to do, like, the dumbest thing you could ever possibly imagine. And so then we kind of had to, like, revisit, like, all right, well, should we fix that? Is that really an issue? Like, you know, and then all these other questions came in, like, is this going to be, like, a common thing?
Yeah.
Do we need to prevent that type of functionality? Or is this guy really just, like, off the deep end and just did the dumbest thing and it's really not our problem? But, you know, our initial reaction really was, like, we just got the stupidest person in the entire world as a customer. And then as it kind of settled in, like, actually, you know what? Like, it's not that he's the stupidest person in the world. It's that our app, actually, whatever we built, like, allowed him to do this ridiculous thing that should never happen. And that's on us.
That realization is immensely painful. We spent over a year building our baby, and we just watched this guy kicking around in the dirt. We're like, what the hell
happened?
And
he did it quickly.
like
within
10 remorse.
Seconds. We're like,
we're
wow.
Like, oh my God, this is impossible. But as designers, every day, we're always looking at ways to improve, right? If we're not looking at that feedback, we're not, you know, removing ourselves from the project personally. Like, we're invested in this project. We spent a lot of time and money in making this project work, right? It's a little bit different than a client project where, like, somebody else is spending the money, so we can kind of step back and be like, all right, you know, it's our designs, but we'll kind of pull ourselves away from it. Here, we're really invested. So you have to work extra hard at separating yourself personally from that project. As soon as someone breaks that, you're like, it's like watching a kid get beat up. You're like, I can't believe my kid get beat up. Like,
yeah. So that's it. Those are, like, the 10 things that we learned. So hope you guys enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the 2012 IA Summit. The IA Summit podcast is sponsored by the UIE Virtual Seminar Program with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. For free access to a virtual seminar, visit uie.com/IAS12. And you can find the rest of the IA Summit podcast at library.iasummit.org.